Don't say.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of the Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
You know, there used to be only two ways to meet for business, over the phone or in person. Now there's a better way. Use GoToMeeting to meet online. With GoToMeeting, everyone sees your computer desktop on their computer screen. So you get the best of both worlds. It's like meeting in person, but without wasting time and money traveling. And your conference calls will be more effective. The best part is that you can actually try it for free. That's right, GoToMeeting is free right now for 30 days. For this special offer, you must visit www.gotomeeting.com/podcast. That's gotomeeting.com/podcast for a free trial. And welcome to the Disciplined Investor Podcast. This is Andrew Horowitz. Welcome, welcome, welcome. How are you? How's things been? It's been a couple of tough weeks, a couple of tough months, actually, for the various indices around the world. A couple of standouts that have been doing much better. Actually, China really did much better lately. And they started to pick up after their little brush with a bear market, and they started to turn up, and things looked a little bit better. Taiwan is looking good. Actually, most of Asia is looking good. But when it comes to the Western Hemisphere and the developed countries, there's a lot to be said about what's going on and how, in fact, they're going to pull out of this situation. We'll talk about that today. We're going to talk about some of the economics that are going on, the fight of all fights, earnings versus economics. And we're also going to have a guest, Kevin DePue from Minionville, will be joining us shortly. And we'll be talking about a variety of technical indicators, including the DeMarc indicators and charting, and some of his long-term views when it comes to markets. So I thought we'd start off with the continuation of what's going on right now and really kind of give you a down and dirty of what's happened over the last week or so when it comes to the markets. Clearly a lot of confusion out there, and I will tell you, I have had a lot of discussion from many colleagues, from the small hedge fund managers to the large, to the private portfolio managers, and I've also talked to mutual fund managers. And frankly, many of them are saying the same thing. It's a very confusing time. It's a time when they're wondering exactly how they're going to make money in a time where markets seem to be just doing their own thing, and every bit of news that comes out, whether it's economic or it's earnings-based, political, or possibly oil-related disaster or anything else, is really throwing the market for a loop. It's almost like the market is treading on such thin ice right now that any possible good news gets a lot of skaters out there. Any bad news has them retreat very quickly, wondering how much more they're going to be able to endure with the cracks that are in the thin ice right now. And, you know, when we're looking at the current situation, you have to consider that last week was a banner week. $84 billion of mergers and acquisition activity that was spawned from last week. The biggest one probably that got things going on Tuesday was the BHP, I'll call it a takeover request, a kind request, for a almost $130 per share for Potash. Potash basically said to the BHP people, hey, you know what? That's a nice starting offer, but come back, and as I quote, with a big boy price when you're ready. I think that Potash is looking to get the price that they had in their heyday, close to about $240 per share, and I don't think that that's really going to be the case, and right now Potash is opening up to other offers to see what kind of other offers can come in and maybe to push BHP Billiton to possibly sweeten the offer. Only a couple of players out there really fit the bill for that. It may look like there's a group out of China, but that's about it. It's a pretty refined grouping and a finite amount of people and companies that would actually be benefited by this. We also saw, which I don't understand, I don't know if you thought about this, but we saw McAfee, the securities and software-based company that is being bought by Intuit. And McAfee shares obviously, you know, skyrocketed on that because they were buying it for a much greater premium. But yet Intel shares were down again. A lot of questions about where the benefit of this is. Where's the fit for Intel right now? And is Intel really just grasping at straws to try to find something, anything, that could help with what's going on with their overall problems that they've seen, the lower cost, and it seems a slowdown in PC sales, as we saw from HP and especially from Dell. Dell's margins this week came out very, very weak, and that was something that had the holders of Dell pretty much throw in the towel at this point and say, you know what, when you fix yourselves, come back, we'll talk a little bit more. So we have this $84 billion worth of M&A activity, which always spikes the interest of investors because they're wondering what other companies can be bought out. With the potash situation, will it be Intrepid Potash or Mosaic? You know, they look at these kind of situations and they say, okay, if the Intel's on the prowl and they're looking to acquire, we look at the Symantec and Citrix and other companies in that space that may do well, or at least related to that space, that may be candidates. Oftentimes what you find that happens is that there's a big thrust up in many of the competitors in the same space initially, only to fall down to reality when they realize that right now that's pretty much a one-off deal. And most of the deals right now have been one-off deals. There hasn't been a major consolidation. We are thinking, by the way, as far-fetched that this may seem right now, that there could be consolidation in the home builder space. If you think about it, many of them are teetering on the last possible level of holding out for something, anything. I mean, you know, it's really been a rough ride for them. They got a couple of great bonuses with the housing credit, first time home buyers credit, and that really special deal where they were able to look back at their profits and losses over the last number of years and bring those back so they can get a great tax savings in the hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars. Right now, where are they? So we're thinking that, you know, you look at the worst players in that space as a very speculative play. Company like a Beezer, BZH, you know, who could buy them? Well, maybe a Toll Brothers possibly be in the market for them, possibly a Lennar, because the consolidation will give them more land and give them a better overall ability to have a greater reach. At the same time, these companies are really at the last leg of where they can possibly be right now as we see it. Very speculative idea, maybe a little bit crazy, and it's something that you may want to take a shot in, but you know what? They move very quickly. They move very much whichever way the wind blows. Next week, we have existing home sales coming up. We saw that new home sales were awful. We saw that mortgage applications were down. So there's really nothing that is going to be a big mover except for the new home sales that come out late in the week. Analysts are expecting somewhere in the neighborhood about 330,000 new homes. Last month was 330 also. That's been the pace. And there was a big drop-off, if you remember, the month before and the month before that due to the expiration of the special credit. But the good news is that the economics that are coming out, we get a reprieve on Monday, but starting Tuesday of next week, the 24th, we're starting to see more things. We're going to see durable goods. We're going to see also on the 25th new home sales, new price purchase index, initial jobless claims again, and continuing claims. You know, these are not... It's a little bit slower than it was last week in some areas, but the leading indicators last week, while they look good internally from a few areas, I mean, they're not impressive. The Philadelphia Fed came in at a negative 7. Now, I want to pay attention to this and talk about this for a second, because the Philly Fed at a negative 7 shows contraction. We haven't seen contraction in any of the manufacturing sectors or the regionals yet. We look at the Empire State and the Philly Fed, et cetera, and the Richmond Fed. None of those have shown a contraction yet. Now we're seeing it. We're seeing retail sales slow. We're seeing LEI leading indicators start slowing. We're seeing the ECRI roll over down to about a negative 10 on a weekly basis. And year over year, it's very, very soft. We're seeing Cisco, John Chambers, say that there's a lot of uncertainty in the future. We're seeing earnings expectations being brought down by analysts. We're seeing revenues expectation and outlook by many companies on their conference calls saying that they are very concerned about the next however long. We're seeing that initial claims eclipsed or right at 500,000 last week. And while the continuing claims look good, if you really look at the emergency claims and the extended benefits and the extended benefits and the extended emergency extended benefits and all the other crap that's being allowed to go on for a total of about 99 weeks, 2 years of extended benefits total available to people right now, what you're seeing is that companies are very reluctant to hire. If they are hiring, maybe they're doing part-time, possibly contract labor, as well as overseas because it's a lot cheaper. Makes a lot of sense. They're protecting their bottom line. But now when we look at the jobless situation, moving up to 500,000, and with a caveat that probably we've seen the highest level right now. Remember I told you about this a few months ago, that July and August, and definitely into August, we're going to see the highest level of unemployment related to census workers coming off their temporary positions. So they're out there now collecting unemployment, and possibly, very possibly, this was the peak of the census layoffs when it comes to the initial claims. So I would consider that when we think that we see a direct line higher right now, because I don't want you to get, you know, too confused or too wrapped up to the fact that the employment situation is getting a lot worse. We will see more in a week and a half or so, 2 weeks. I don't think it's getting better. I actually think that the unemployment rate is going to go up. I actually think things are going to get a lot worse. And because we had talked about this starting last year, you know, that the fourth quarter of this year is going to see a significant slowdown into 2011. And then you compound the situation with what's gone on with the euro and European area, the slowdown slightly in China. You see the problems with the domestic areas of the United States and the high unemployment level. And it all adds up to a really bad situation. Now, the other thing I want to talk about is, not to leave you on that bad note, but there is something I want you to take a look at. I don't know if you've ever traded currencies and if you ever thought about it, but a great diversifier for a portfolio, and here's an idea that we've worked on. It looks to us like there's a very good chance that the Japanese will have to do some intervention when it comes to the yen. Now, here's the setup. The yen is currently trading about 85-ish for the dollar. Okay, so what does that mean? Well, we're at a 15-year low on the dollar to the yen. Or I said a different way, the yen is at a 15-year high to the dollar. Now, what is the problem with that? It's very simple. When it comes to the yen, the Japanese exporters, which is a big part of their stock exchange and their country and their, you know, overall way of making money, GDP, et cetera, just like it is for us, the problem is that it becomes very expensive for other countries to buy goods, other companies to buy goods. And why would you go to Japan to buy a product from one of their companies when you could buy it from a competitor much cheaper? That's actually what happened, we believe, in the last quarter, where a lot of orders were moved over to Europe when the euro was so low, and that helped the GDP for that short period. That's going to dry up. Well, Japan, on the other hand, knows about this. They have done a great job, really not great job, but they've done a big job, we'll say that, of doing a lot of currency manipulation over the last decades. And right now at 85, if you look at that number, the car companies are pretty much working at a zero margin. So there needs to be some kind of stimulus slash intervention. Well, if that happens, the yen is going to drop. Let's say it drops to 90 to the dollar. They want to actually press their yen currency down. So we think that you may want to take a look at, as a small portion of your portfolio, or as what we did, at least for our clients, we went into, well, depending on how you want to look at it, we went in for IRAs into YCS, which is a 2x dollar-yen inverse. So if the yen falls, you'll be profiting there. Or we went into, for non-IRAs, where you can actually short, we shorted FXY. And that, again, is the dollar-yen. So you'll make money if the yen falls with FXY, or you'll make money if the yen falls if you go long YCS. So take a look at that just as an idea, because currencies right now are moving pretty dramatically. And as we see the Japanese market be so dependent on a lower yen, it only makes sense that they go, even with the high amount of debt they have right now, and even with the extraordinary amount of pressure they have to cut that down, it makes sense for them to do something to actually bang down that yen and bring that back, because they will benefit the economy in total. Right now, the yen at these levels is a major hindrance to any growth, which is non-existent to begin with Japan. So there's actually a few things that can happen there, and we think that would be something you should look at. It really looks like it's a very, very interesting play right now. So the other thing I want to mention is that when you look at the retail right now and you look at technology, we are starting to see a slowdown in those two areas. And yes, there are pockets of good. Walmart said things were getting a little better, but they also talked about how tight consumers have been. Same thing with Home Depot and Lowe's. Sears was just awful. A lot of the teen apparel was terrible. Technology, questionable. When you look at technology and retail, these are usually the forerunners. If you remember back to many of the other times that you saw run-ups in the market and then moved down sharply, it was usually the leaders in and out were technology and retail. Just consider that, because that's what's occurring right now. Retail and technology are starting to slow down. So when you add that into all the other things, the only thing that really can be hoped for right now by the bullish camp is additional stimulus, quantitative easing, and an easy monetary policy continuing for some time in an environment where we have no inflation. Well, we have the environment that there's really no inflation to speak of, even though PPI ticked up a little bit last week. But at the same time, we have to wonder, where is it going to become a time when the government is going to be able to do additional stimulus, probably not before the midterm elections, and probably the way it looks right now, not after the midterm elections. So we're in a little bit of limbo right now. Administration, Congress is between a rock and a hard place, and it's going to be yet to be seen how that's going to all play out. But I think what's happening is the economy is clearly slowing, earnings are going to be compressed, and we're going to be waiting for another stimulus. And if that happens, that's great. But if not, watch out below. All right, let's segue right into our guest. And coming back from a long hiatus off, I mentioned in the beginning of the show, we have a great guest today. His name is Kevin Depew. He is the editor-in-chief over at Minionville. If you haven't been over to Minionville, you're missing a great opportunity to seek out not only educational material, but great ideas from what they call the professors, as well as some great comedic relief when it comes to the market. Some of my favorite on that site truly are. So we had him, I guess, Kevin, it was a bit, maybe, was it like a year ago that you were on last?
Yeah, that's probably about right.
Wow. Lots of things have happened since then. I mean, lots. Let's talk about some of the things. Let's set this up. So Kevin is more of a, you're more of a chartist, right?
Well, that's right. I try to look at things from a macro perspective and then combine that macro perspective with shorter term technical analysis or indicators that are based around Tom DeMarc's work.
Now, Tom DeMarc, it's interesting because for those of you that don't know it, if you would just start studying it, and help me along here, Kevin, but if you start studying it, it almost looks like voodoo at first.
Well, it does. I mean, it really does. My background was in voodoo before that, even, because I used to use point and figure charts.
Oh, God.
And that's another form of voodoo right there, with all the X's and O's. And when you first see it, it's the same kind of thing. I remember the first time I saw a point and figure chart, I thought, well, there's clearly no way that I'll ever be able to understand what this is. Tom's work, it can look a little like voodoo when somebody sees it for the first time. But it's fairly simple. I mean, what Tom is trying to do and what he's developed is a way of comparing opens and highs and lows and closes to various bars, and he's uncovered a couple of different, or not a couple, but quite a few unique patterns that the market have manifested over time, and to me that's really been the foundation of the work I do, is based on Tom's work.
Yeah, I've read some books on Tom DeMarc's studies. I got to tell you something, unless you use them all the time, you can't really implement those, because it's there's a lot of different things going on. There's a lot of different indicators. Some of his core ones are easier to work with, but then again, I also find trouble in understanding not only the basics, but okay, which trend are they going? Which way are they going?
Well, part of the problem is that by nature, human beings, we want there to be patterns,
right?
And we want there to be patterns when there aren't, and because it makes the world easier for us to understand. Tom's work treats markets as dynamic things, so while when an indicator records on the chart, it'll stay there forever. It doesn't vanish simply because the market didn't do what we wanted it to do. And so it is a dynamic way of comparing opens, highs, lows, and closes to each other And just really letting the market speak, as opposed to trying to, you know, put your own framework and your own ideas on top of it and hoping that it conforms to those. So
Right. That's
why I gravitated towards that. And I know that there are many different methods that people have used successfully to make money. I don't think this is necessarily the best one, but it's just the one that makes it easier for me.
As with anything else, there are flaws, there are ways that are better. There are also, and I think probably the best way to put this is that maybe the DeMarc studies, and maybe the one that you're looking at, maybe works better on a particular market, whether it's commodities, whether it's stocks, or maybe something that you've designed. Maybe it happens to respect the levels much better. I'm just saying that as an assumption. I mean, you know, point and figures are basically support and resistance points, right? I mean, from lows
right.
to highs.
Right.
Yeah.
I don't think that's this is where it gets a little controversial, because I know that some people will say that, well, you know, okay, Tom DeMarc's TD sequential works best for, you know, stocks versus commodities, and then he wants to use TD combo for commodities. I know for a fact that Tom doesn't believe that. Not having looked at other things, I don't either. I mean, what it comes down to, the foundation is that if you believe that human beings are herding behavior creatures unconsciously, then there will be patterns that manifest through the group's actions that they may not even be aware of. And that's true whether it's he's applied the indicators to things such as the migration patterns of geese successfully. And they also seem, when I apply them to economic indicators, they also seem to show exhaustion points. So it's the foundation of it is in patterned herding behavior, unconscious herding behavior, and then on top of that, looking for exhaustion points. So it's a combination of a little bit of trend following with mean reversion. And so applying those two things together so that it's not pure, well, here's the trend and we're going to follow it. It's looking for the origins of trends and then the exhaustion points. But again, I mean, there are many different ways that and many different types of indicators and analysis that incorporate parts of this. To me, this was just the easiest and it was the most robust. It applies across multiple time frames from weekly, monthly, quarterly down to 5-minute and tick charts.
Right. So let me ask you this. When we talk about the markets these days, and when you're looking at either the market or any of the charts, let's kind of get into some of the things that are going on. As I see it, there's a gigantic conflict going on right now, and it's a global conflict. And the conflict is between economics and earnings. We could probably bring in political issues and all that, but let's just leave it as economic is everything outside of maybe what a company is doing, and earnings are, of course, what the company's results are. We've seen some companies, I mean, kind of crap it up pretty good and really, you know, be not looking so good. And we've seen some outliers like the HP fiasco that's going on and all that. But generally speaking, earnings this quarter, the quarter that just passed and that's still going on, has been pretty good.
Right, they have. And, I mean, you could just look at the S&P 500, basically. We're in a range of roughly 1075 or so. We've overshot a couple of times on that. But in DeMarc terms, we've never qualified a downside break, which is important. That's just some of the rules that are required of price behavior to say, okay, 1075 has been broken. But over the past 30 weeks, we've been roughly between 1075 and 1130 or so. And we haven't broken out to the upside. We haven't broken down to the downside. In fact, right now, we're trading below 1075 as you and I talk. And the probabilities for now are that this is going to be an overshoot to the downside that's wrong, and then we move back up into the range again over the next week or so.
Now, let's talk about that. So if the breakdown point is 1075, that's what you just said, right?
Right.
Okay. Which, by the way, is also a number that we have using a different methodology, which is interesting because then you have those convergences.
Right.
Okay. So, and as a matter of fact, there's a couple of different points, and the next point we have after that, I think, is 1056 or somewhere right around there. But and what's interesting is, you know, people say, well, why are you buying individual stocks? What's the difference? Well, the difference is that right now the market's juice on an individual basis or on an ETF that covers the market are kind of working the same. And what you want to do maybe is, as we see it, is short the market and go long the beta.
Right. I think that's a very wise way to handle this market. And a lot of people probably either they're on an individual basis, they're not I don't want to say they're not smart enough, but they're not sophisticated enough in their approach to be able to take advantage of that situation.
Right, they don't have the experience. They don't have the experience. I mean, that's the bottom line.
Exactly.
Right.
But, you know, Andrew, that brings up the larger point, is that since 2007, about the middle of 2007 until now, when you are an individual, and there were points of this before between around 2002, 2003, but if you're an individual and you have investments in the stock market, then it used to be the case, and people don't, a lot of people who are, you know, haven't been investing for more than 15 or 20 years, they don't understand this. But it used to be the case that when you went home in the evening and you flipped on the news and they would say, okay, well, the Dow was up 25 points or the S&P was up 3 or 4 points, you would not be able to take that information and apply it to your portfolio.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason for that was that the correlations among individual sectors and stocks was different.
Right.
It wasn't all one market. Right now, and this has been the case since 2007, when you go home at night and you turn on CNBC or you pull up a computer and pull up a web page where you want to find out what the market did, you know exactly what your portfolio did, because your portfolio did exactly what the S&P 500 did. And it doesn't matter if you own semiconductor stocks, doesn't matter if you own consumer staples. Within several basis points, that's exactly what your portfolio did. And that used to not be the case.
Yeah.
We will get to a point again where the sectors begin to break apart, the correlations begin to break apart, and stocks begin trading again based on fundamentals and their own fundamentals matched up within the sector. But it's going to take a couple of more years, and I think it goes back. That's a longer-term picture of what you just started this out by saying, you know, the war between earnings. You know, on a macro scale, it's the war between private capital and central banks, or a battle, which is it's always been a battle, but right now that's where we are.
So when you look at the current state of affairs when it comes to, I mean, the markets right now, when they are so highly correlated, and it's not only the markets, by the way, it's also commodities.
Right.
And you can find correlations in a lot of places. You got currencies. This is the interesting question that I think really hasn't been answered too well, is what's the reason for that? Is it because individual investors are out of the market, therefore the institutions, just by their very nature, go by policy statement and say, okay, this much in stocks, this much in bonds, this is the line in the sand where we will pull the shorts out or pull the shorts in or whatever? Or is it the advent of the ETFs that really came well into being in 2006, 2007, that allows for an individual to buy the market, and why bother with anything else but just buying a piece of the market? Or is it something entirely different that we're not even talking about?
Well, I think it goes back to the flooding of markets with excess liquidity by central banks, and that's a very broad generalization. But what you mean, what one means by that is that since '98, when markets began to shudder around the world a little bit, the path by central banks was to increase liquidity to the markets, because the feeling was that among policymakers was that, well, this is not, these sell-offs, these mini crashes are not symptomatic of true market fundamentals. They're just symptomatic of a small absence of liquidity at a particular time, and this goes back to the mid-90s. So you had, 15 years of that. In the meantime, because that excess liquidity is going to areas that are inefficient, businesses that probably should not exist but are able to tap into the money that's flowing into markets, then you start to have everything moving in the same direction, because there's no more, the markets are no longer looking at which businesses are actually producing things. Everybody's producing things.
Yeah.
Our production now is simply excess capital, or excess liquidity in the form of too much capital being allocated in too many poor areas. And so on the downside, the deleveraging that takes place, you have the same thing where everything sells off at once. It doesn't matter if it's soybeans or Hewlett-Packard. They're both going down the same, because the unwinding of that deleveraging, the unwinding of that leverage takes time, and it takes a toll on all markets. So, I mean, it's still going to be the function where things move up together and then they move down together, and I don't think we're quite finished moving down, but I think we are getting closer to more reasonable levels of leverage in the system. But it's still, it's going to take several more years.
So when you say you're not finished going down, do you think that this range that we have, this 1075 to 1100 and change is you mentioned before that we overshot it below 1075, but that's the short term you're talking about.
Right.
And then
several weeks ago we were down as low as 1020s. Mm-hmm. And then it came right back up, and that was, the rules for price behavior, according to DeMarc, showed in all those instances where we've overshot it that we haven't qualified the break, and that's true today as well for this week.
I got to interrupt you. The 1020 didn't qualify either?
No, even when we went down that low. It just did not. According to the rules, and this is working on a weekly basis, that 1075 level in DeMarc terms is on a longer-term weekly basis.
Okay, gotcha.
We have roughly 30 weeks, or 33 weeks or so, where we've traded between 1075 and 1140 or so.
Yep.
So now we're down again, getting to we're below the bottom of that range. Longer term, I think I was talking about this with some friends of mine yesterday about, I think there's a consensus out there that if you pick apart the S&P 500 and try to place a fair value on it, looking at past bear markets when the market trades below book value, you come up with around 500 or so of fair value on the S&P 500.
Really?
And I think that's fairly, among the bear cohort, that's fairly consistent, and most people will say around 500 or 600 or so. One more new low for the S&P 500, and that will be close to the end of the 13-year structural bear market. But when you say that, my response is, how long? Suppose we do go down to 500. Suppose that happens sometime. Maybe there's an October crash and we go down there. How long is the market going to be at 500?
Right.
It's not going to be there very long. And I remember it was very tough in March of 2009 when we were down around 700 or so. Not a lot of people wanted to step in and buy stocks there, which was a great opportunity. But, again, for somebody with a 20-year time frame or 15-year time frame, we've had 13 good years of a solid bear market. And, markets do not bottom when the economy turns around. The markets bottom, and then after that, several years later, the economy turns around.
Yeah, the problem, though, is that we're starting to see little inklings that things aren't as good. I still think that the government has one more potential torpedo to give us some kind of a stimulus, whether it's going to be right now. I think the big overhang about the Bush tax credits are coming off or not. There is just a very business unfriendly environment with this administration. There is confusion about what's going to happen in November midterm elections. We can go on and on about the confusion. And what is the one thing that the markets don't like? It's uncertainty, right?
Right.
Those words were used by Bernanke when said that there was a lot of uncertainty, and then we saw what happened, right? That's like the one word you don't say. You don't say fire in a movie theater, and you don't say uncertainty in any public address about the market, right?
That's right.
But then the brilliance of John Chambers, by the way, followed up a few weeks later with the Cisco announcement that he said unusual uncertainty again. And you saw what happened.
That's right.
come on. If we haven't learned, let's get this together. But anyway, so do you see the economy as? Do you agree with me that there's probably one more shot somewhere in the system for another shot of a stimulus that may be more of a direct line, and that's going to be kind of like the last shot they have here? Or are we kind of seeing the economy that's done its thing? It's going to continue down, and we're going to see more of a revaluation. By the way, the 500 valuation on the S&P at this point right now, if you're looking at it right now, is totally wrong. I'm sorry. It's just if you're seeing $80 per share right now, I'm not talking about tomorrow, I'm not talking about next week, I'm not talking about next quarter.
Right.
I'm just saying right now, you'd have to have PEs close to the 5 or 6. That's pathetic. That's ridiculous, and you don't have that in this circumstance. You want to say a PE is of a PE of 10 during really bad times, and you want to say, okay, $80 or $70, okay, $700, $800, I'll go with you there if that's the projection.
I agree with you. I mean, my point in bringing that up was that that's the bearish case for where stocks, people, or, that's where they say, oh, well, if we go to 500 or 600, the market will be fairly valued, and we can say that crash is put in a bottom. But, I think in this kind of structural bear market, we don't get that. I really don't think the market goes down. I think your point about the stimulus, that I agree with that, too. It's probably going to happen. But I guess the main thing that I'm concerned about is that the retail investor is going to totally miss out on this.
They're leaving
the market. They're not really relevant on the margin anymore the way they were.
Right.
And meanwhile, the economy is going to be so tough, and it's going to look so tough and feel so bad that it'll be 5 years into the next bear market before retail investors come in and start to get excited about it again, at least. And that'll be higher.
Bull market or bear market?
Next bull market.
Bull market, yeah, I thought you said bear. Okay. But you know what they're doing is they're all going to bonds. It's this unbelievable move right now. And we just actually, I got to send this over to you. You know how I send you the daily things that we're looking at? I'm going to send you this. We did a cross-section of bonds, of mutual funds and ETFs, just to look at kind of, you know, what's doing what we do regularly. But I want you to see this. It is unbelievable how much bonds are up in the last 3 months.
Yeah.
And it's kind of scary because there's a calculation that we look at called convexity. Are you familiar with that at all? Okay, so convexity, for those people out there that are not familiar with that with bonds, there's different things you look at. You look at, like, maturities, and you look at things like, a yield to maturity, for example, when you take the pricing into consideration. You look at duration, which is a calculation that looks at, okay, what's the real duration, the maturity of this, when you consider interest payments and things like that. But convexity is sort of like the risk inherent in a bond price. If rates move up quickly, it's always a condensed period that you're looking at, and what would happen. But here's the interesting thing. When you look at a bond, let's talk about a short-term bond that's at 1%. Let's just look at a 1% bond, whatever that may be, a treasury. And let's say that interest rates go up by 0.5%. Okay, so they move differently along the curve. But if they go up by 0.5% at a 1% bond, that's a 50% increase in the interest rate. But it's only probably about a 12 or 13% increase on the long end of the bond. So that convexity, what happens is you're going to get a quick move, and you get a very large amount of change in the bond, and you can get scrunched on those midterm to, you know, those bonds. Not a pretty situation, right?
No, it's not at all. I think you're right. And as a matter of fact, there are some DeMarc sell signals showing up in a variety of Treasury fixed income products right now.
Yeah,
it's been the case over this week. So, you know, I think.
Are you tracking the TLT or?
Yeah, TLT is the one I'm thinking of for sure on the ETF side. I mean that's all those things are. It's the perfect storm for again the retail investor, who by the time this bear market does end will be absent from the market.
Right, it's like the time that growth was in play over value, and everybody's on the wrong side of the ship.
Right.
You know,
right.
Exactly. So gold and silver, I know you were tracking those. If I recall correctly, you were waiting for a significant sell-off in silver, I think, if I'm not mistaken. You were willing to wait a long time. At least that was the time that we were looking at, because you were looking at monthly time frames, and that could be a long, long, long time of waiting. But you also said you were patient. Did you ever get into silver? Was that a trade you made at all, or are you still waiting?
Well, it's not a trade for me. I bought silver and some gold in 2002, 2003. Early part of 2002, and that was based on point and figure work then, believe it or not. You know, those I've had some silver and some gold. I've sold most of that gold since then, but I'm longer term, I'm very bullish on silver. For a trade, I was looking for it to come down to about the 9 to 10 level, which it never did, but I still have some silver that I've traded and bought since then. You know, sometimes it just, you don't get your entry point that you want. But this week is fairly interesting. And, you know, again, silver has come right up to DeMarc level. It's 1869, and just cannot break through that level. So that's where we've been really since November of last year, about the time we were talking. And we got the October, I think, might have been when last time we spoke was last year.
Yeah, maybe.
We did get the sell signal and on the charts. Then and we came down as low as 14 and change or so, and I was expecting it to go lower, but it didn't. So since then, we've just been in this range.
So you wouldn't be in gold, though, right now, huh? I mean, everybody seems to be in gold bonds and
actually,
gold.
Well, gold is I think gold is definitely tradable. I never question anybody trading gold. In fact, it did break through a pretty significant level in DeMarc terms earlier this week that has a target up to 1267. So I think it's certainly tradable, but I'm not a gold bug. I think that it's largely a worthless metal for most people to deal with. It's just, it's I just don't. I don't get the gold case. I'll be honest with you. I just don't.
It's a shiny rock that gets dug up from the earth, and I can say to you, "Oh, look how beautiful this." Same thing with a diamond, by the way. I mean, but you know, now all the gold bugs that are listening get all PO'd and upset here. But you know what? We've assigned a value to it. Silver, on the other hand, I will say, has much more industrial use. Yes. Than gold, but all right. So
absolutely, you know, I think silver longer term is way more is that. I mean, here's the thing: if you are a gold bug, if not a gold, I'm not going to put it in those terms. If you're bullish on gold because you find problems with the currency system, because you believe the United States has too much debt and the global economy is going to eventually unearth the fact that we can't pay our debts and worry about sovereign defaults and all this, and the debasement, destruction of the currency. So, okay, that's your thesis. You're going to buy gold because of that. Well, I mean, do you really think that the powers that be, the so-called elites that run this fiat currency system, that they're going to allow people to subvert it by suddenly exchanging gold for things? I mean, first of all, the first thing that's going to happen is that trade in gold is going to be outlawed. There's probably a case to be made that politically they'll just confiscate it, which is what happened in the 30s. So, I mean, the stakes are even higher now. So I think anybody who owns gold, that you're basically, really trying to time something that is going to be politically and physically impossible to do.
And the bigger the bigger problem also is that if you bought GLD as an example, and you use GLD as a investment for this, you know, tell me how you're going to get your gold one day.
Well, I mean, here's the thing, is that there are people that will listen to this right now, and they'll say that I'm an idiot. That's fine. My advice to them, if you think I'm an idiot about this, is that you should right now, with interest rates where they are, go and sell everything that you have, everything that you can possibly have, and borrow in paper dollars as much as you can possibly borrow and buy physical gold. That's the trade that you should make because you're going to win on two levels. The first level is that the financial system, if you're the gold bull, is going to break down, so you're not going to have to pay back any of that debt because the banks are going to be insolvent. The currency is going to collapse, and so you're going to be sitting there with a big pile of gold and just waiting for somebody to develop a new currency system. I mean, that's the trade to make. And if you believe that, then that's the one you should make. Otherwise, you should just stop talking about it and stop getting mad when people point out the obvious, which is that gold, we are not ever going back to the gold standard. Never. It's never going to happen. We might go to a basket of commodities. We might do a partial silver backing. But we're just never going to go back to the gold standard. Right. It's not going to happen in our lifetime.
Right. No, I agree with you. And then, again, there's a lot of other problems with the actual, you know, you got to have a good belt because putting a lot of gold in the pockets doesn't work. You know, in terms of spending things. And we could talk about the, you know, the better use of money. I mean, I like gold for short-term traders and for people who want to have a piece of that because of that security, and which, you know, depending on what side of your mouth you talk out of. You're going to talk about the sovereign currency issue, or are you going to talk about the inflation issue? Because gold has always been the inflation protector. Well, just to let you know, I've looked at numbers, and I'm having a hard time here because inflation is not seemingly showing up anywhere in the Western developed countries, in Asia, in parts of India, clearly in Brazil, and some of South America, but there is nothing here. So, on that,
you're absolutely right. I mean, this is people are mistaking. It's very tough to get wrap your mind around it. That deflation is not about a nominal price decrease; it's about the unwinding of debt and the destruction of debt, and that's what's going on. That's why this is a deflationary environment. That's why things are deflating. The best, right now, the best protection against inflation would be assets like stocks. Stocks are, if there is a successful reflation attempt to stave off the deflationary debt unwind, then it's going to manifest in stocks.
Right, because then you have a lot more spending, you have a lot more money flowing through the system, et cetera. By the way, just a side note, because we've mentioned this a couple of times now, how the stimulus money, the money that's in the system, the various the things that the Fed has done and the government, and et cetera, we say that, well, that has gone through the system and it's kind of making all sorts of problems for it. I read a fascinating article that showed that our stimulus has effectively help to prop up most of the rest of the world, not directly per se, not like, okay, we sent this one money, not like the AIG deal where we backed the, you know, we backdoor save the banks through them, but
right.
that the money that goes through here, because our manufacturing that we do is offshore in China or Korea, Vietnam or Taiwan, that our money is going there, and that's what's helping them out so much, and that's why we haven't seen such a great amount of benefit here in the U.S. from any of the things that we thought we were going to get out of it. And it was really kind of an interesting read, because I think the question has come up by a lot of people. A lot of people have written me, you know, where, Andrew, where is the stimulus money gone? You know, okay, there's some infrastructure going on and development of that, and I see a little bit of a bailout for the banks, et cetera, but where's the rest of it? Why are we seeing a 500,000 print on initial claims? Why are we seeing our total unemployment situation in the 10% range for the normalized levels, as well as 16% for the U6 levels and 17%. And it's just, you know, a never-ending battle. Where is it going? Well, it's going to other places, and that's why you see Taiwan coming out this week with a 13% print on their GDP. You're seeing right. that they're raising rates in India, and they're doing just great over there. You're seeing that countries in Asia overall, Korea, Singapore is on fire. China's doing fine. They slowed down a little bit, but they're slowing down to 10% GDP, and everybody's all worried. And, you know, everything besides Japan. Japan's a disaster area. But, you right. know, we're seeing that Brazil and Chile, and we're just seeing a whole different environment outside of the U.S., and a lot of that's coming through there. But anyway.
Well, I mean, then all you have to do is look at the, you know, look at the open credit card accounts plunged 23% from the 2008
right.
peak. I mean, this debt's being paid down, so when the stimulus... If the stimulus goes into the economy at all, it's going to places that you just mentioned, while here it's being used to repair consumer balance sheets.
Right. The other thing is that, you know, you look at a lot of these things, these reports that come out. I want to kind of, maybe you can help me with this, because we saw the level of credit card delinquencies dropping off very nicely over the last several mm-hmm. months. Everybody makes a big deal about that. The problem, though, is, as I see it, those numbers are apt to look good because, number one, of course, we saw the peak, but secondly, you know, a lot of things have been written off already, so the bad debts are just gone. They take it off their books. They're cherry-picking who gets credit cards these days, and they're only giving it to the people with the good credit that will have the good records, and thereby
right.
you don't have the delinquency problem. And, you know, it's a whole different – it's like we're looking at a different basket of statistics versus it's not a constant anymore.
No, it's not. I mean, and you can see that the way the credit card companies break down their tiers of consumer lending. On the top, things are great. And as a matter of fact, for the top tier, which makes up really a small portion of their credit card lending, and by credit card companies, I mean the Bank of America's
Capital One,
mm-hmm. MasterCard.
Right.
But the credit quality in the top tier has improved dramatically over the last year and a half, but for the middle and the bottom, it's still declining. It's still getting worse.
Right,
and that's real. And more, even worse, you've had Capital One. I think in their last, I was on the last conference call. They made the point that what they were seeing were people who were formerly in the middle to the top middle tier were actually falling down into the lower tier. And that was the result of a combination of things. First, it was credit limits being lowered, along with the delinquencies that you mentioned. And you know what happens to your credit score when you have a company lower your rate? It takes up, you know, then all of a sudden, instead of if you had 25% of your available credit being used, depending on how they lower your credit limit, then all of a sudden you're at 50% or 60% being used,
right.
and that lowers your
right.
score. And then that has a carry-on cycle effect or circular effect where the other companies, if you have credit cards through them, say, hey, wait a minute, we just ran the report and show that this guy's using 50% of his available balance. So then they lower your credit line and so on and so forth. So
they're shaping it. But the credit card companies are trying to shape the delinquency levels as best as they can right now to make the best
right.
foot forward, of course, rather than having a full pool of information. It's very much like what's going on in Europe, as I see it. You know, they're trying to shape what things look like. I mean, the fact that Germany had a 3% outward print on GDP outlook for their growth factors recently is a very temporary situation in our minds. You know, we're right. seeing that they saw that, but at the same time, it was because the euro was so low and they got a big order flow in, and they're going to see a cash for clunkers on the other side. All right, let me ask you this. First of all, what do you use the DeMarc indicators with? You use Bloomberg? What system are you using it with?
Right, I'm on Bloomberg system.
Okay, that's the Bloomberg professional system. For those of you that don't know, it's not available for the Bloomberg charts, but there are other places that you can get actually indicators through the DeMarc, and their organization is very friendly, by the way.
Yeah, it's Market Studies. I think it's marketstudies.com or .net. I'm not sure which one, but they've actually launched a new service for individuals.
Oh, great. What about the dollar-yen? What is your DeMarc indicators telling you on the dollar-yen trade? Right now, we're finding that the yen at 85-ish is terribly overpriced for what it is. Again, it's almost like the rush for safety into bonds that individuals have done, the rush for safety either in the U.S. dollar or in the yen, which, by the way, doesn't make a whole lot of sense to me why people would be rushing into the yen as the safety trade, the country with the most bloated deficit structure. Right. It just doesn't make any sense.
Well, I'm bullish on the dollar yen, both on daily and weekly basis. On daily, we have a DeMarc buy setup, and on the weekly, we have a buy setup. On the daily, we're very close to need another new low to get an actual TD sequential buy signal on dollar yen daily. So, close to that.
Yeah, that's good. All right, we are actually long. We're also long the dollar yen as of a couple of days ago, and we're short the bonds as a full disclosure. Which has been
right.
a little bit tough the last few days, but it's almost at a point that it's gotten to a point that the stampede is showing us that it's almost a point of capitulation.
Right. Well, if you look at TLT, for example, that's the iShares 20-plus year bond fund. I like the weekly charts a lot because I don't do a lot of trading. I don't want to trade a lot. I like to hold positions for a while. The key level there is the TD sequential, TDST, which is a trend determining line, is at 106.56 for the TLT. And so we came right up to that level, but even if exceeding it, it's not going to qualify a break of that. When you have exhaustion showing up on the daily charts, I don't know if this is the top for the TLT, but I think it's certainly vulnerable on the upside now, and you just have a little too much enthusiasm for it.
Yeah, much too much enthusiasm. When you see a bond fund go up 3% like that, 3% or 4% in a matter of a week, you have to, or whatever the time period is, you have to, it's a very, very short period of time. You have to wonder, by the way, I also wonder how much the TLT, the futures, because they use futures in there, right? How much the futures inside of there are really pressing also the bond market itself.
Right.
You got to wonder about
that. That's a good point.
Okay.
Well, even on a monthly basis, there is a monthly target that was based on a breakout for the TLT that occurred back in back in July.
Mm-hmm.
Gave the target of 108.62. I know when just to clarify something that the levels like this 108. I mean some I could just say 108. But, those are precise levels because they're calculated based on mathematical formulas that Tom's created. So they tend to be very precise. So it's not some kind of faux precision the way people look at it like that.
No, so sometimes when they use a Fibonacci and they just, kind of throw the Fibonacci down and don't, they're not looking at the right numbers. They're looking at either the extensions or looking at just somewhere in the middle of the day, not looking at the closing price. Yeah, I understand.
Yep. So, we're still probably... it might be a month or two away from hitting that 108.62 level, but even on the monthly charts, by the end of the year, we should probably have a TD sequential sales signal showing up on the monthly chart for TLT. And I think at that point, especially once we get through the September-October period, which are typically a vulnerable time for stocks, or actually September to December have been the worst drawdowns over the last 8 years or so, that at that point we'll probably see, if nothing else, the asset allocation among professionals and some of the institutions, especially in the early part of next year, going from bonds into stocks, which will then, right now even stocks on an asset allocation level are probably...
Oh, they're way under.
Yeah, they're way undervalued compared to bonds. So it just takes time for some of the institutions to be able to act on that. It's not like they can go in and
Well, definitely, you'll have that January rally. If everything was, if right now was December, okay, I would say that I would project for a January rally only due to the fact that nothing more about economics, nothing like that, but just a massive reallocation of a balanced fund from their position of bonds into some stocks. That's it. Simply as that. Now, that may not last more than a week, but I'm just saying you would see something substantial happening there.
Yes.
So, all right. Last, again, we're talking to a gentleman who knows his DeMarc indicators, a chartist for many years, patient investor. His name is Kevin Depew from Minionville. Minionville.com. You got to check that out. It's awfully cool. And also, right now we've seen this big M&A activity. And I think this week was one of the largest that we've seen in a long time. Is this a symptom of something?
Well, there's a ton of cash that corporations have right now, which has both good and bad components to it. It's not the tendency among market watchers is to just say, okay, well, there's all this cash, and so that's good. The reason they have the cash is because they're very risk averse, which is not very idealistic for stock markets.
Right.
When companies are risk averse, it's not very good for hiring. It's not very good for those of us in the real economy that have jobs. So there's a double-edged sword. But it does. There are a couple of things that are going on with all the cash on the balance sheets. We've seen a ton of shareholder enhancement activities announced over the past two quarters. By companies in all sectors, whether it's buying back shares of stock or increasing dividends, and in this case, just doing acquisitions.
Yeah, because it's interesting. It's like inventories. Are higher inventories good or bad? It depends. It's always right. Yeah, exactly. The answer is yes. I look at inventory numbers. I'm like, how is somebody looking at just straight up inventories or trying to comment? Inventories are up, and that's a good thing. A lot more manufacturing. Well, hold on. Maybe inventories are up because nobody's buying anything. You have to look at an inventory to sales number as an example. Same thing here when it comes to the cash. Why do they have cash? Is it because like an Apple that just amassed cash because they were just, incredible amount of phone sales and computer sales, et cetera, not much in the acquisition, no dividend, et cetera? Or is it like a Microsoft, the same situation with $40 billion on the books? It just is not acquiring, not doing anything. They're scared. What's going on with that? So, they don't find any acquisitions that would be accretive to their earnings. So
right.
I think I agree with you that, there's a question right now. It appears that this week, M&A activity was hot, $84, $85 billion of M&A activity between Potash and Intuit had an acquisition. There was a few different ones, about six of them, I think. But
Intel, McAfee.
Yeah, McAfee. I don't get that one. I don't get it. I don't get it.
I don't either.
I don't get that one. McAfee, I always thought was the biggest short. We never touched it because of a lot of different reasons, but the thing is that the security systems are being offered for free for a lot of companies, and they're being tightened down. My understanding is that Intel believes that or the strategic point of this acquisition was that Intel is looking at the mobile applications and the opportunity to embed McAfee's security systems into mobile applications. That kind of money doesn't need to be spent to do that.
No, it doesn't at all.
I don't get it. It just looks like they ran out of ideas or something. And it's so outside their area of expertise, it just is very troubling. But whatever, we can go on about that. But yeah, so the M&A activity this week, last week, or the week before could have been, dividend hikes and buybacks. So I think there's, a lot going on. I always get concerned, though, on the dividend and buybacks, and we'll end on this point, that when companies are getting, like, for example, this week, Intuit came out with numbers. They came out with good numbers on the earnings. They came out good numbers on the revenues. They beat across. They also enhanced and increased their outlook. And they came in with the dividend. I believe a dividend, but I don't know if it was a dividend, but it's definitely a share buyback plan. That's all you have to do. You just have to put in a share buyback and all that. But anyway, that's what this week is, right?
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
Yeah. So we'll see what happens next week. It could go either direction these days, it looks like. But from what I'm hearing from you, this range is kind of what you agree with is happening, and we're not finished with the range quite yet.
Well, we're not. I mean, in the broad, I just try to avoid the extremism on either side, either overly bullish or overly pessimistic. I mean, the world's not going to end, but it's going to feel like it, especially when we start progressing with unemployment around 10%, the structural unemployment those issues where people run out of benefits. And then you combine that with the lowered tax revenues for states, for federal government, states and cities. Services over next year will probably have to be cut, basic services. And in the meantime, you'll have underfunded pensions where people are working 20 years and out, and then somebody with a full pension that used to be on the fire department or sanitation is suddenly decides, you know what, I got a full pension, but I'm going to reenter the workforce to compete against somebody who doesn't. All those things are going to happen. They're going to get ugly, and it's going to be, it's going to be tough. But, that's not the stock market. That's the economy. And the disconnect is that stocks don't do what the economy does. So, there's some probability we may have actually already made the bottom. I don't think that's true. But, you have to factor in that I could be wrong, that we don't go back.
You're talking about the bottom for this year.
Yeah.
You're talking about the 666.
I mean, just for the structural bear market.
Right.
We've had 13 years where stocks haven't done anything.
Right.
So, I mean, that's a pretty good bear market right there. If maybe it's another 2 or 3 years. So I think once we get to the 15-year mark, which would be about 2012, that, I just don't think, even now, if your time frame extends beyond 10 years and you're willing to buy some stocks and hold your nose when things go down and get tough, that you're going to be better in the long run than somebody trying to time the market and get in when it feels like everything's going to hell.
Well, we have a little bit of a different attitude. 10 years is a little bit of a long stretch for me. I'm having a problem sometimes with 10 minutes, I'll be honest with you. But, it's tough. It's a very confusing time, let's just say that. And I agree with you that there are great opportunities. There is a disconnect and sometimes a connect with the economy and the markets. But let's just agree that the fact is that there's different ways to skin a cat. Or if, for those of you animal rights people, skin a apple.
Or, yeah.
You can't skin apple.
My largest allocation is actually to Japanese stocks right now.
Really?
Yeah, and that's because I think that those have a major bottom that will form over the next few weeks or months.
And how do you do that? You do that through an ETF? Or what do you do?
Through a variety of ETFs, and then I also have some in some of the friends and family accounts that I help them manage. They have either a 401k that has some Japanese funds there, which are not ideal, but that's what you have to work with.
I hear you.
But the Nikkei, I
will tell you this, Kevin. The one thing I can say about Japan is that it's either feast or famine for them, right? So when the yen is going down, okay, there's a real good opportunity. The yen is going down now. So that could be really good for them because obviously what's happening is they get a better exporting base, and it's really, really good. The only problem, though, is, it's when you get that equilibrium where things are really good for them. You get a slight move down because you don't want to enter into a position of Japanese equities when the yen is going down, because then maybe the equities will go up, but your yen's going to offset it.
Right.
So you got to find that equilibrium point. And right now, my only concern, and I'll just disagree with you on this, and I apologize, but my concern is if we're bullish on the yen right now, or bullish on the dollar yen, I should say, that could be positive for stocks, no question about that. And hopefully they've bottomed as much that the yen movement to, let's say, from 85 to, picking a number, 90, okay, that movement will be offset dramatically by that. So maybe the alternative thing to do would be hedge out the yen risk.
That's certainly a possibility. That's another way to play it.
We can talk a lot more. Again, Kevin DePieu, he is from Minionville, a fine fellow. I enjoy talking with him, and I encourage everybody to visit Minionville and check out my favorite little characters over there, Huffy and Boo. Huffy and Boo, right. Huffy and Boo.
And
Huffy and Boo. Funny fellows. And also read all the writings from the various professors, etc. Kevin DePieu, thanks for joining me on the Discipline Investor Podcast.
My pleasure, Andrew.
All right, bye-bye. Well, that's going to wrap it up for this week. Episode number 175 on the Discipline Investor Podcast. Thanks for joining me this week in the doldrums of the summer, as we say. And, of course, when we get back in the next week or so, we're going to see hopefully some volumes picking up and a commitment one way or another in this market. Right now, it's important to stay somewhat hedged, as we believe, and into some of these currency discussions. Also, investing in those areas as a great opportunity right now, as you're seeing currencies move dramatically. Beyond that, it makes sense to be a little bit more careful since we passed a couple of important lines when it comes to the S&P 500 and the major markets. the Russell, the NASDAQ did a little bit better, but still a lot of these, if not all of these, are trailing under their major moving averages. And that is a big concern when it comes to institutional investors. There is very little, if no, retail investment going on right now. Most of the money is flowing into bonds. We think that the bond market rally that we've seen that has been so extraordinary reached almost a capitulation point last week. And we're going to see that slowly but surely drift down, even with an economy that is actually shrinking, is actually compressing, is actually going to be getting weaker moving forward. We'll talk more about that over the next few weeks. Again, we have Kate Stalter coming up, and we have someone who you really want to listen to next week coming up. He is a guy that we've had on before, and I think you're really going to enjoy him. Terry Bedford, he called the market right last time. Let's see what he has to say this time. And when we get back next week, we're going to dig into that. Thanks again for listening. 14-minute virtual tour. If you're looking for somebody to manage your money, check it out. It's on thedisciplinedinvestor.com. All you have to do is click on it, and it will give you a 14-minute virtual tour that I take you through on how we manage money, why we do the things we do, what the strategy is, some of the longer-term details of what we've actually done. And check it out if you're looking for someone to be managing your money for you. $50,000 or more is the minimum investment. And, come on aboard. We welcome you. I'll see you soon. Thanks for joining me. This is Andrew Horowitz, the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
The Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contain forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor regulated by the SEC. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.